Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 88. My name is Karen. Your name is Kristen.
It is.
That's good. That's good. I'm glad that I got that right. This week, we are doing a deep dive on Bast. We're back to the Egyptian mythology.
Yeah.
I'm actually ridiculously excited for this, and I had a ton of fun, like, looking up information about Bast and just learning stuff. It helps when you have a cat, too, because you're like, oh, you could be the embodiment of a goddess.
I'm really excited, too. We've had a nice little departure from the everyday, you know, the every episode we're talking about Red Pyramid, which I have thoroughly enjoyed so far. But we had a nice little break while we covered other things, and I'm really glad.
Yeah, we're back. It feels good to be back in the groove of, like, just, like, normal. Like, back into your routine, you know?
Agreed.
Yeah, especially for, like, the next month or so before we get into some other stuff. But, yeah, I'm super excited. If you're excited, you can contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. We're going to get into our news and updates for today. I just went into, like, a perfect news anchor.
I was going to say, it did sound very... We're going to talk news and updates for today. My name is Karen, and I'm...
Yeah. I did not know why I do that. I don't normally do that.
See, either that or you could be running a ride at Cedar Point. Thank you for riding America's rock and roller coast. Sorry, I'm okay. I'm done now.
I've never been to Cedar Point.
Aww, after a while, you know Cedar Point. I was going to say, people from Ohio who have been here for a while are like,
it's on my list. I'll get there. Yeah. But yes, news and updates for today. I wanted to say that Fury of the Dragon Goddess by Sarwat Chadha got a starred review from Kirkus, which is very exciting. And that is coming out soon. That's coming out on August 1st. And we will definitely be covering both City of the Plague God and Fury of the Dragon Goddess on the podcast coming up. So stay tuned for that.
AKA start reading, because I have to start reading.
Yeah, we're really going to try to not do this at the last second like we have been. Kristen and I, we are what you call procrastinators.
Master procrastinators.
Yes.
Because I've been doing it my whole life, and I've never missed a deadline yet. I'm saying never, but I probably missed one. And so, I have a really big problem with, oh, I've got a couple weeks. Oh, I'm good. I have a book that's coming out on Tuesday. Not my book. There's a book coming out on Tuesday that I'm supposed to write a review for.
I have a book coming out on Tuesday.
Have I started reading it? Nope. Because I'm me. This is how things work.
I don't usually promote my own stuff on the podcast, but I do actually have a book coming out on Tuesday.
So if you have not yet discovered Karen's many series, you've got two series,
series,
that she co-writes, please go check them out because they're good fun.
Yeah.
I helped her write the first couple.
Yes, you did. Actually, that's one of the things that I miss most about not living together is because you are such a good person to bounce ideas off of that it's, like, harder to do through text now, but...
Yeah.
As I'm sitting here staring at my murder board full of stuff that Kristen commented on the other day.
It's like the master, you know, like in showrunner rooms for TV shows where they have like the board with all the cards on it. Karen has a whiteboard that has all the beats and some of them are disturbingly... disturbingly labeled.
Yeah.
But I understand because she writes like murder mysteries and like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Thrime Kriller. Wow.
Wow!
Crime thriller. Wow. My brain is done. It's checked out. Sorry, guys. I'm going to do my best. She writes crime thriller books. And so, there's always murder involved. Yeah. We've had many conversations about what would be the best way for this person to die.
Yeah.
Like, would this form of death be, like, more believable? Or should I go with, like, something like... Yeah, we've had that conversation.
Getting back on track with that, Reed Riordan put out an interview with Gracie Kim about The Last Fallen Realm, and I'll be honest, there's nothing really new in here, but it's a cute interview because Gracie's super cute and I love her answers, so definitely go check that out if you're interested, at least skim it. And then Reed Riordan also put out an article titled, Who is the Most Powerful God or Goddess in the Riordanverse? And I will warn you, there is a King Chronicles spoiler in there. So be very, very careful if you decide to read it.
I'm not looking.
Yes, Kristen's not allowed to look. And also, I thought it was very brave of them not to choose Zeus as the most powerful. I think their conclusions were really interesting, but it's just, you know, a silly, fun article.
Yeah.
I would also like to remind everybody that your Alessia Trunfo, The Sun and the Star cover glows in the dark because I definitely forgot about that until Rainbow Crate tweeted it. And I looked at my book because I was like, wait a second. And it totally glows in the dark. I can't believe I forgot that.
That's adorable.
Yeah.
I did see something about them reaching out to like the correct publishers and things
yes.
to see about maybe putting out another run of them, which I missed out myself, so I definitely understand, like, the appeal, and so I'm really hoping they'll get permission to run
yes.
another print of them.
Thank you so much for mentioning that, because I knew there was something else I was looking for, and I couldn't remember what it was, and I was like, oh, well, probably wasn't that important. No, that is very important.
It is.
And I'm glad that you remembered that.
Yeah, so keep your... I'm sure if you follow Illumicrate on, like, Twitter or something, you'll probably see if they end up doing a reprint, but you can always check their website, too, because I'm sure they'll have details
yes.
on there.
For sure. And Mark, I'm sure, will be
probably
retweeting
yeah.
a lot of stuff because they've been on top of that.
Yeah.
And every time Alessia does more artwork for The Sun and the Star, Mark always tweets about it.
I saw that one the other day that melted my heart.
Yeah.
Like the drawing with, it was the moment where he's like, how about now? I forget what it was. It was like... it was where Nico kisses Will
yeah.
and is like, I forget, it's something like that. And he goes, how about now? And he goes, all better. Whatever. But like the look on Will's face, like,
yes.
oh my God, it's so cute.
It was super, super
but
cute.
But yeah, Mark lost their mind over that too.
Yes.
So I was like, yep, I'm in good company.
Yeah. And speaking of covers, we have the Chalice of the Gods UK cover from Khadija Khatib, who is the one who did the Son of the Star cover, who is the one who did the Daughter of the Deep cover, and so it's really exciting that she gets to do the Chalice of the Gods UK cover as well. And you can pre-order it right now from Waterstones, and there is an exclusive edition that comes signed and with sprayed edges. This is really becoming a thing.
It is.
And it's not something that, like, Rick has ever really done in the past, so it's really exciting that we're getting it now.
I learned something new. This has apparently been a thing in the UK for a while. Like, apparently all these different book boxes, like Illumicrate and all those, have been doing painted edges on books or, like, sprayed edges or stenciled edges on books for a while.
Oh, okay.
But America is just discovering this, apparently. again, Fourth Wing has taught me a lot. And I just kind of learned this, so I'm interested. I went and looked now to see, and I love what they kind of did with the painted edges
yeah.
on this. That's really cool.
It looks really nice. I totally pre-ordered a copy.
The UK one?
Yeah, I had to, because I was like, I need all the things. And Kati's painting is really quite beautiful, and she tweeted out the actual painting without the title and stuff. And I love when artists do this.
Same.
Especially because when you're writing articles, to not have the title on top of it is, like, so helpful. So thank you so much for doing that.
It also becomes really fun to make desktop backgrounds and phone backgrounds
yeah.
and things where you don't necessarily have the title on there. Like, mm-hmm. you don't need it. You just want the art.
Yeah. And this one's really colorful. It's really vibrant and exciting. So I love that. It's completely different looking from the American version that Victo Nye did.
I was going to say, which follows the Victo Nye cover.
Yeah, exactly. And I will say that it also has serpents on it and lightning bolts and, like, magic swirlies. But other than that, it's very different. And the really interesting thing is that Percy is holding up Hermes' staff, which is not something that we necessarily knew was going to play into this story. So
yeah.
now I am very, very interested in this.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I saw that symbol, I was like, why do I know that symbol? It took me way too long to find it, but I'm glad that I did, because
yeah.
now my brain's going. In other great news that Kristen brought to my attention, Cotty said that this isn't the only cover I'm working on in the series.
Quote, end quote.
Yes, which is very exciting and makes me think that the mystery book we were talking about last week is actually going to be a sequel to Chalice of the Gods.
It's really funny because when we first started talking about Chalice of the Gods, when we just first found out that he was writing a new one and we didn't even really have anything to go by, we found out that we were, like, I forget, it was specifically, we had prognosticated that there were going to possibly be, like, three because it was, like, what was
it? In the description,
the three challenges,
said something like three quests to get into New Rome University.
Yeah, and so we had kind of said, like, oh, they could really easily make this three books. And so it just cracks me up that Rick has been hammering on standalone. This book is, you know, like, he hasn't said probably, he's been calling it a standalone because I think he didn't want to make promises he couldn't keep, which is totally fair. But we've had this inkling that we, you know, it felt like this could be a new, smaller, like maybe three book series or something. And this kind of stamps that a little bit harder. Like, we don't, again, we don't have details, we don't know anything, but it does make me think that Chalice of the Gods is the beginning of a small three-part series or something.
Yeah, I would put significant money down on the fact that what he's working on right now is going to be a sequel to Chalice of the Gods, because, yes, he's been calling it, like, a standalone, and he's specifically been saying, like, I don't know if there will be more, we'll see how it does, which is why I didn't really guess last week that the mystery book could be a sequel to Chalice of the Gods, because I figured it wouldn't be until it was released and he saw the reception that they would decide whether or not to work on another one. But to be perfectly honest, with how long it takes to put a book out, if they want another release next year, a year away from this one, it's smart to get on it now.
Especially with all his other projects.
Yeah, and I think with everything he's working on, they're really not worried about putting money into it and, like, getting money back, basically, so...
Agreed.
Yeah. But I'm glad we, like, kind of know it's not been official yet, but I feel very strongly that this is it. And when they do announce it, then we'll find out.
And we'll act surprised.
Yes, we will. Definitely act shocked. Speaking of being shocked, though, this next bit of news did surprise me a little bit. Once I got thinking about it, I was like, oh no, that actually makes sense. But Variety reported that Disney will not have any panels at San Diego Comic-Con this year, along with a lot of other studios. Mm-hmm. HBO,
I think DC said they weren't. I'm pretty sure Sony isn't.
Yep, Sony. Paramount, I can't remember if that was one of the ones. I think they're still waiting on Paramount.
I think Warner Brothers said they weren't.
I think Warner Brothers was also waiting a little bit. Yeah.
But yeah,
there's a lot of major studios, like Marvel and Lucasfilm's not going to be there because they're under Disney. They won't have panels. Becky was very specific to say that Disney will still have a presence at San Diego Comic-Con, which makes me think that, you know, they always have a booth on the show floor. Both Disney Books and, like, Disney Plus, like the actual Disney Studios, has a booth on the show floor. So that's probably what their presence will be.
Yeah.
And it's possible that even though Disney doesn't have an official panel, maybe people from Disney, in whatever form of work they do for them, could be on a different panel, like a mixed person panel.
I could also see them doing, like, an installation outside.
Yeah.
Like, something like that. I could see Disney putting together something like that.
Yeah, that's very, very true.
Aw, man, if they do a mini Camp Half-Blood, I'm gonna be pissed.
Ooh.
They're not going to do it.
Okay.
They're not.
I was about to be so mad, and we don't even know if it's true yet, and I was just, like, my whole body got hot. I was furious that I would miss that.
They're not going to do it.
Because there was already a pretty good chance that I wasn't going to go this year because I'm traveling, and I get back from where I'm traveling from 2 days before Comic-Con starts, and I was like, I could do it, but I don't really want to.
Yeah.
And just with how slowly Percy Jackson stuff is rolling out, I was already kind of like, I don't think that they're gonna, like, do anything huge here.
Yeah.
But all of this, by the way, is because of the writer's strike and the director's strike, I think, even though they're getting close to...
They haven't officially struck yet, but they're going through negotiations
and
stuff like that.
Yes, yeah, yeah. basically people are not willing to promote Disney yeah. stuff or a lot of the other studios as well.
And that, I was going to say, a lot of that also just has to do with supporting the writers who are striking. Yes. Like, directors and actors yes. have a hard time. Kind of, it doesn't, it's not crossing the line, but it feels like it because yeah. you just, you know, you don't want to.
It's just loyalty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that is helpful, especially when it comes to comedy, because so many comedians are actors and writers.
Yes.
And so that kind of, it makes it feel like you're crossing mm-hmm. lines, even if you really
aren't. Loyalty and solidarity, I think, mm-hmm. is the word there.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So, very likely, we will not be getting any information out of San Diego Comic-Con, which is okay. We'll hang tight. D23 is in September of this year, and I was speculating that maybe they... I was already wondering if they would hold off Percy Jackson information for D23 versus Comic-Con, because D23 is specifically, like, a Disney convention.
Yeah.
And Becky also said that she doesn't know anything about D23 yet, doesn't know if there'll be a presence there, so...
I feel like that is kind of, like, a duh situation.
Yeah.
Like, it's gonna be one of their bigger properties. It's coming out next year. At some point, even if it's just to announce when it's gonna air, like, even if that's all they're telling us is, hey, guess what, guys, we have a premiere date for Percy Jackson, it's gonna be such and such.
Yeah.
Like, even if they don't do a trailer or anything else, I can feel like that might be something. I can't imagine they'll go all the way through D23 without doing anything for Percy.
Yeah. I agree with that because they're going to want, especially if it's coming out early the next year, September's a decent time to start ramping up
yeah.
promo stuff, and they could have things ready by then. The problem, and also the writer's strike, I would assume is going to be done by September, but we don't know that for sure.
We would all hope.
Yeah, and so it also depends on just what they have ready, because the writer's strike is really, like, halting the process in a lot of different ways, and Becky even commented the other day about how the social media person on the official Percy series page, like, isn't doing a whole lot because the writer's strike is kind of just making things weird right now, so there's not a ton to actually talk about. So we'll just have to wait and see. I would love to go to D23, but, you know, we'll
yeah.
see what happens.
That's a different animal, but
yes.
maybe.
Yeah.
At some point.
We'll keep you updated on all of that. I want to jump into our discussion now, our deep dive on BAST, because I'm actually ridiculously excited to talk about this goddess. I will say that I got most of my information from Wikipedia, because we are not doing, you know, a research article here.
yeah.
I'm just trying to give you an overview.
Yeah, some general info, good to knows kind of
yeah.
things.
Yeah, and I also went to worldhistory.org and got some information as well, and a lot of it lined up, so I feel, like, pretty confident, but, like, you know, don't write any research papers based on what I'm telling you here. Especially because we've learned in the past, too, that a lot of these stories, like, have different variations. And I find a lot of the, like, oh, this goddess and this goddess were, like, kind of the same person, but kind of not. Like, I find that very confusing and hard
yeah.
to, like, wrap my head around. And I'm like, you know, they're gods. Maybe I'm not supposed to understand. But
yeah.
It makes kind of putting this into something organized and easy to comprehend a little more difficult. So Bast, also known as Bastet, and a lot of the time she is referred to as Bastet, but I will pretty much be calling her Bast throughout this,
yeah.
is an ancient Egyptian goddess, the origin of whose name is uncertain. So we're already starting off on solid footing here.
Awesome.
Yeah. It's possible that her name means she of the ointment jar, as her name was written with the hieroglyph for ointment jar, and she was also associated with protective ointments. So
I love that it's very specifically an ointment jar.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah.
I know a lot of things were just in jars back
yeah.
then. But I find that fascinating.
Yeah. And it's also possible that the word alabaster might, through Greek, be derived from the name of the goddess.
That would make some sense.
It would. I find that very interesting. And in Greek mythology, she was known as Eleuros, the goddess of cats and the moon, and was sometimes equated with Artemis, which I think makes a lot of sense.
And here's where I make my, if anyone knows the point I'm about to make, congratulations, you've officially nailed me down, yeah, West Wing. CJ has a moment where she finds out that she accidentally disrespected a Basque statue.
I remember you telling me this before.
Somebody handed it to her while they were in Cairo. She threw it in her suitcase. It got broken. She is tried to super glue it back together, and now she's talking about having an ancient curse cast on her. Yeah. She talks about the goddess Bast, cats, the moon, the whole thing. Yeah, so it makes me giggle every time I hear, like, the goddess of cats and the moon. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, yeah, like, it all just falls in line, but it always makes me giggle and think of CJ, because she was my first foray into learning about Bast.
That's awesome.
I don't think I knew anything
about
it.
That's so random. Like, that's such a random show for you to learn that from, but I really love that.
Locked away.
Yeah. I think that this is also one of the equivalencies that makes the most sense in my head, because Artemis is a hunter goddess. Mm-hmm. Cats are great hunters. The moon, nighttime, like, all of that. Even, like, personality-wise, Artemis is a little bit, like, sassy in Percy Jackson specifically. Yeah. So, like, I kind of get it.
You know, if you think about it, cats are moon and dogs are sunlight.
That makes perfect sense to me.
It really does.
Yeah.
Like, there's no real way to equate it, but it just works.
Yeah.
So I'm leaving it at that.
Which is actually hilarious that you say that, because Bast was originally a lioness warrior goddess of the sun.
Interesting.
Yes, yeah. She is the daughter of Ra, the sun god, and Isis, the mother goddess, the consort of Ta, the patron god of craftsmen and architects, and the mother of Mahis, the lion-headed god of war.
Interesting.
She was also sometimes the mother of Nefertum, the god of perfume and sweet smells, further associating her with the ointment jars. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of interesting, too. She was the protector of Lower Egypt and defender of the king, and therefore Ra, because the pharaoh was, like, a direct line to gods, and, you know, a lot of the times they saw the pharaoh as, like, the embodiment of the gods on earth. And she's also frequently shown as the pharaoh's nursemaid and protector, which I thought was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because of her role, she was one of the most popular deities in ancient Egypt, second only to Isis. Which, I mean, that's like the mother goddess. That's mm-hmm. like somebody who's, her roles in
she's
everyday
everywhere.
Life.
Like,
yeah.
Mother Earth, almost.
Yeah.
Like, kind of has that feel.
Funeral rites and all that kind of stuff. So, like, Isis was incredibly important. The fact that Bast came in second
yeah.
is, like, a pretty big deal. She was also a goddess of pregnancy and childbirth because of the fertility of the domestic cat. And she was the goddess of home, domesticity, and women's secrets. I really love that one.
I mean, yeah.
That she's the goddess of women's secrets. That's just so cool to me.
You men can have your stupid secrets. But Bast is protecting mine.
Yeah.
So.
Exactly. She was also the goddess of protection against contagious diseases and evil spirits. And in my mind, this makes so much sense, because contagious diseases often come from rats. And what do cats hunt?
Right.
Rats.
It all is logical.
Yeah.
You just follow the path.
And I really love this association of, like, this is a cat goddess who's protecting us as people from disease. Like, it's just, it makes so much sense in my head.
Mm-hmm.
But the protection against evil spirits always makes me think that part in The Mummy when Brendan Fraser is, like, holds up the cat and it, like, hisses.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
It really makes me laugh.
That's perfect.
Yeah, it's awesome. So, going back to the whole alabaster thing, in art, she was often created from alabaster. So that kind of also connects her to that a little bit. Her symbols were the sistrum in one hand and the aegis in the other. And I found this really interesting because I feel like I had heard of the word sistrum before, but I didn't actually know what it was. So a sistrum is a percussion instrument consisting of a handle and small metal rings attached to a U-shaped metal frame so that when it's shaken, it would, like, clank and jangle.
So kind of like a rudimentary tambourine.
Oh my god, you're right.
Like a,
I did not put that together. But yeah, that's
yeah.
very much what it's
yeah.
like. Yeah. Oh, you're so smart. I love that. Okay. It was associated with musical and joyful deities, which I do kind of feel like Bast is pretty, like,
I was going to say, and tambourines have that general, like, you don't use a tambourine on a slow song.
Yeah.
You really only use it on upbeat, fun, you know, up-tempo kinds of things, so that would make some sense.
Yeah. And it had important associations with religious and ritualistic practices, which I think is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the part that really fascinated me, because as we already know, because we already talked about this a bit, the Aegis was either an animal skin or a shield, and in Greek mythology, it was a shield used by Athena and Zeus and sported the head of a gorgon, mm-hmm. okay? Now, in Egyptian mythology, when it's associated with Bast, it was a collar or a gorget, which is basically like a scarf wrapped around the neck, which I had never heard of that word before. And yeah. Apparently, like, later on, it turned from being fabric to metal, and it was actually, like, to protect your throat, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And the collar that she often wore sported the head of a lioness, which makes sense. But, yeah, I just, like, I was not expecting to read the word Aegis when yeah. I came across her. I was like, oh, that's fascinating. So, 2,000 years after her first appearance, she transformed from a lioness and a lion-headed goddess to a domestic cat and a cat-headed goddess. She used to be very closely associated with Sekhmet, who is another lion-headed goddess. And again, this is like, what do you mean by closely associated? Like, they were the same person, they were different versions of the same person, they, like, hung out a lot, what's going on here? But as Sekhmet grew more aggressive, Bast's images softened over time. So I kind of like that it's like, okay, they're very similar, but like one's one end of the spectrum, the other's the other end.
Yeah.
Domestic cats were highly revered in Egyptian society, partly for their ability to combat vermin, but also snakes, especially cobras. And Bast is often depicted battling Apep or Apophis, an evil snake and the enemy of Ra. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
As I was looking this up, because I was like, I've definitely heard the word Apophis before, like the name Apophis.
It looks familiar.
Yeah. And I think we might have even mentioned it in our overview at some point.
We may, yeah.
But I was like Googling some stuff just to make sure I had some background information. There is an asteroid named Apophis that was once believed to be Earth's deadliest asteroid threat. And I just feel like, why would you name the asteroid that? You know?
Like, I mean,
it just seems like not a great idea.
I think we have a habit of naming celestial things.
Oh, yes.
After, like, especially Greek gods.
Yes.
But I kind of find it funny that they dipped their toe into the Egyptian well for Apophis.
Yeah. And but also, like, Ra is, you know, the sun god, the main god,
mm-hmm.
big guy, the Zeus of Egyptian mythology, you're naming this asteroid that's careening toward Earth as his biggest enemy.
They were trying to make it clear to Ra that you should destroy this.
Yes.
Like, hey, if we name it this, then, you know, Ra yeah. will take it out.
Yeah, I was like, can Bast protect Earth from Apophis? Like, there was a whole thing going on in my head. But I found it very interesting.
Yeah.
Cats of royalty were, in some instances, known to be dressed in golden jewelry and were allowed to eat from the plates of their owners. So, I mean, they were really revered in Egyptian society. Now, this next story I find fascinating and a little sad. When the Persians invaded Egypt in 525 BCE, they painted images of Bast on their shields, rounded up as many cats as they could find, and drove them toward the city of Pelusium, which was like a stronghold, like it was a very important city that they wanted to take. They drove the cats ahead of them, and fearing for the safety of the animals, the Egyptians surrendered.
I mean,
they would not harm the cats because they didn't want Bast to be angry
right?
at them. And the Persians were like, you're so dumb. And they were like, that's fine. At least Bast isn't going to be mad at us.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. If Bast is basically second kind of in their pantheon, then it makes sense that that would be worth it to them. Mm-hmm. Like, that would absolutely be a worthwhile yeah. thing to surrender for.
And I think that, you know, it could be, like, a sign from them, you know, that this is not a battle worth fighting or right. something like that. Yeah, I could see them totally, like, thinking about that deeply. Bast's religious sect was centered in the city of Bubastis. The Egyptian name for this city literally means the House of Bastet, and was one of the richest and most luxuriant cities in ancient Egypt. So again, just a lot of emphasis on Bast.
CJ Craig says Bubastis in that episode, and really? It makes me laugh every time.
That's funny.
It's just an interesting name for a city, but she talks about it too, so
that's
when
cool.
you said it, I was like, oh yeah.
It's a fun name to say.
It is. It
Bubastis.
Is. Bubastis.
Bast's temple was surrounded on 3 out of 4 sides by water, which was a typical component to temples dedicated to lioness goddesses. The story goes that a lioness, fiery and wrathful, was once cooled down by the water of the lake and, transformed into a gentle cat, settled in the temple.
I was going to say, I find it interesting with, like, cats' relationship with water. Most people think of them as,
right.
like, polar, you know, like, cats are, yeah. you know, like, near water. I find it funny that, like, that is a feature of it.
Mm-hmm. But I think it also makes sense when you think about the transformation from lion to cat,
yeah.
like domesticated cat, because, you know, lions would be very happy to go land
and they love
water.
I was gonna say, from what I remember, like, they like water quite a bit, and like it. Like, the lions at the Toledo Zoo are very lazy, so I don't think I've ever seen them do anything like fun ever. Actually, I don't know if we even have lions at the moment, because yeah. But in the like, I've seen, you know, other zoos, and like, I've watched all those nature shows on Disney.
Yeah, before.
And like, I'm pretty sure they do really like water, so that's funny. Because like, tigers love water and like
yes.
stuff like that. So
yeah,
it makes sense that kind of the domestic cat is more, you know, shy about water than it is like the big cats.
Yeah, exactly. I love this idea that, especially as a, you know, associated with the sun, this and the fact that like the lion version is a bit more aggressive and wrathful, it's cooled by the water, turns into the more gentle domesticated cat. It's just like a really beautiful kind mm-hmm. of story.
Mm.
300,000 mummified cats were discovered when the temple was excavated.
Jeez.
It is a lot of mummified cats. The death of a cat would leave a family in great mourning, and those that could would have them embalmed or buried in cat cemeteries. So there were whole cemeteries dedicated just to cats. I mean, I cannot overstate how important cats were to Egyptian society.
Yeah.
Each year, the city of Bubastis would throw a festival in Bast's honor because, quote, feasts of drunkenness were thought to appease the lioness goddess.
Why not?
Children weren't allowed, which was very smart,
mm-hmm.
and women would engage in music, song, and dance on their way to the festival. Now, this next part I found really, really fascinating, and this is where our PG-13, you know, line comes in. Women were freed from all constraints and even displayed their genitals. Quote, this raising of the skirts by the women, described by Herodotus, had as much to do with freedom from social constraints as it did with the fertility associated with the goddess.
I mean, I can see it.
I am obsessed with this idea that Bast, who very much is a protector, a fertility goddess in a way, she's about domestication. Women's secrets, though, I think plays into this.
Yeah.
That these women would, like, flash people, and that, like, they're throwing off the constraints of society. As a feminist, and for anyone who's interested in feminist history and stuff, like, I would love to learn more about this. That is, like, super outside the scope of this podcast, but, like, I would definitely read some articles on, like, what this means and, like, how that came about.
Well, and, like, I'm sure this is probably derived from Bast and the idea of Bast, but, like, cats have always been kind of associated with femininity in general.
Yeah.
So, like, it makes sense that, you know, I don't know if it's the cart before the horse or whatever
right.
here, but it makes sense to me that, like, a celebration of Bast or a celebration of, like, the cat and lion goddesses would also embrace women kind of throwing off whatever yokes and constraints of society have been placed on them, which back then, I mean, we know that there were really only male leaders, at least a lot of male leaders in that time. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure there was pressure for women to, you know, conform to certain societal standards or whatever. So I kind of love that there's this festival where you've just got women, like, feeling free and doing all the things that they're not allowed to do. And it, yeah, it's like Rumspringa for Amish people, like, where you take that... You know, when you reach certain age, you go and you experience the rest of the world and, like, see what it's like and all that. Like, it kind of reminds me of that because it's supposed to be, like, a celebration of freedom and, like, all that stuff. So, yeah.
That's cool. Yeah, I find that really fascinating. And if anybody has further reading, let me know because...
Pass it right along because yeah. Karen is in... Yeah, definitely. She's gone into... academic mode, like, I want to know. I want to know all the things.
It's hard for me not to when we get into these, like, deep dives and stuff. Like, I just get really excited because, especially with Egyptian mythology, there's a lot that I don't know. Like, I have a very good general overview, but, like, a lot of the specifics, I just find it really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, we have to tie this into the King Chronicles, and unlike Percy Jackson, where we already knew how the story was going to end... You know, I don't want to talk about their rules in the books because we're kind of reading it for the first time in a lot of senses. You definitely are, and I honestly don't remember anything else that happens in this book, so I kind of feel like I am too. And so I just want to talk about, you know, our introduction to Bast and kind of now that we have some actual historical and mythological evidence to back up what she's like to kind of compare those things and then see, you know... if we can make any guesses about what's to come. So first and foremost, I think it makes total sense that this is actually the first deity that we meet and that she's been tasked with protecting the kids. I mean, that matches up with everything that she was about in ancient Egyptian mythology.
Yeah, and I think when it comes to, like, the Egyptian pantheon of gods, Bast is one of the most easy to, like, nail down.
Yeah.
Like, I know who Bast is. I knew who Bast is before I read this book, so the minute I heard about Bast, I was like, oh, okay, the cat goddess, associated with the moon, associated with, like, femininity and all that stuff. Like, I knew who that was. And so I feel like it's very smart of Rick to start out, just as you did in Percy Jackson with Poseidon, starting with a son of Poseidon and kind of going from there. Like, people know who Poseidon is. They know, you know, god of the seas and all of that. Like, you, there's always a few big names that you know from these, just that you've absorbed from popular culture. So I feel like it's really smart to start with Bast, someone that's very recognizable, that if you Google it, you'll get the Egyptian understanding, like the general understanding of what Bast represents. So, yeah, I feel like that was just Rick being very, very smart and saying this is one that people are going to recognize. And then from there, you can kind of get into some of the other gods that are not as easily recognized, including the one that Zia started fighting, Serket, that started fighting. Like, it makes it easier to kind of add these other gods into the story.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think there's something to be said about, like, our familiarity with cats as well, because I think that was one of the things that he did really well, is, like, Rick plays into, like, her domesticated cat side with, like, attacking the wrecking ball and all that kind of stuff. We know how cats act, so it's very easy for us to, like, get on the page with that. But I also love that he made her a fierce warrior, too, and it makes sense when you think about her origins as the lioness goddess and her origins as a protector and all that kind of stuff. Like, this is... You know, cats, I think, in general, are a bit more, you know, they're domesticated, obviously, and they're super cuddly and cute, but, like, they're hunters. Like,
yeah. Well, and in, like, lion society, it's basically the opposite of human society. Women are, like, the female lions.
Yeah.
are, they're the hunters, they're the fighters, they're the protectors. The, you know, the males in the species look different and are very, like, iconographically, like, they look specifically, you can pick out a male lion. Whereas a female lion, they all look kind of the same, it's harder to find. But, like, male lions don't do a whole lot other than procreate.
Yeah.
And, like, kind of, they can kind of be, like, the head of the pride and, like...
They do fight, but, like, it's not the same.
Yeah. Like, women are the ones protecting the kids. They're the ones doing the hunting. They're the ones going out and putting their lives on the line to bring food back and to take care of their pride. So it's, like, I find that really it makes total sense that Bast is also this fierce warrior, because that is the lioness way. Like, that is what they do. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The lioness way. I like that a lot. Yeah, so I'm really curious to see what else she's gonna do in this book and this series, because right now I feel like she's really already kind of fulfilled her role as the protector, and I'm curious, like, if she's gonna be in all three books, if she will continue to be their protector. I also really want to know if she's going to fight Apophis, if, like, that's going to be a large part of what happens.
I mean, in the chapters that we've read so far, and where we left Bast, she was fighting Sir Kett, and the kids had to run. So, like, we don't actually know, I'm assuming Bast isn't going to be defeated by Sir Kett and just...
Yeah.
But, like, we don't actually know, like, what's going on with her at the moment. So I am really interested to see how she continues to be involved. I have to say that I feel like she's going to be a significant role player in at least this book, if not the rest of the series.
Yeah.
She's just one of those gods that you can't use once and then disappear.
Right.
Like, she needs to reappear. She needs to kind of be present. And I feel like her needing to protect Carter and Sadie, it makes sense, like, logically.
Yeah. And there's that history between her and their mother, too. Mm-hmm. So, like, we still have questions about that. So I would very much assume, you're right, she's at least is going to play a major role in the rest of this book and hopefully the rest of the series, because I really like her.
And I do think it would be cool to see her fight Apophis. Maybe not in this book, because, like, I feel like Set is enough of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe, like, in one of the later books, I would be interested to see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Isn't the title of the third book, Serpent's Shadow?
I can see it on your shelf, so yes.
Ooh, okay. So,
The Throne of Fire and then the Serpent's Shadow.
Okay. Do you think the serpent is Apophis?
I mean, it could be.
I mean, that would make sense.
There are a lot of snakes.
Yeah.
When it comes to Egyptian, like, mythology, it's just same with Greek, honestly. There's a lot of snakes in Greek mythology,
yeah,
too. So I feel like that could mean a lot of things, but Apophis is not a bad prediction.
Mm. Well, we'll have to see if we're right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But speaking of the Kane Chronicles, I'm so excited to be back to our chapter reviews. I feel like it's been ages, even though it hasn't, so it's just, like I said, good to get back into the routine.
Yeah. So today we are talking about the Red Pyramid Chapter 12, entitled A Jump Through the Hourglass. This is another very brief chapter. It was like 6 pages.
Yeah, it was short.
It was very brief, but it's significant. It has some stuff. The recap is Zia defeats a goddess who respawns pretty damn quickly. Time to go.
Yeah.
Because that's really all that happens, is we get to see Zia actually fighting Sir Kett and see kind of what that looks like.
So. Yeah.
Okay, so when we left Sadie and Carter, they were just becoming safe in this chalk circle that Zia had helped, like, form. I believe Carter or Sadie, one of them had to, like, run and put statues or something on, like, the north, south, east, and west to kind of form the circle.
Right, yeah.
But, yeah, Zia went and helped, like, form the chalk circle. So now they have a protective barrier. How protective? We don't know. Sir Kett is, like, a goddess, so it's probably not gonna stop her, but we'll see what happens. Zia fights Sir Kett pretty effectively from behind the barrier. Like, she's using the powers afforded to her as a magician, and it's very impressive. And, like, you see, you know, scorpions launching themselves at the circle and them disintegrating in a fiery cloud,
yeah,
of dust, just like...
And then when they retreat, they, like, crawl inside her robes, and I was,
yeah,
like, oh, that's,
yeah,
so creepy.
Yeah, so when Sir Kett sees that the scorpions aren't going to be able to cross this border, she calls them back, and that's when they crawl under her robe and then become, like, a giant scorpion tail? No, thank you. And she, of course, uses that giant scorpion tail to try and attack, which Zia defends by, like, throwing her wand.
Yeah,
it's her magic wand. It's her magician's wand. She, like, throws it at her, which I freaked out about at first. But we'll get there. I thought it was important to talk about this description of Sir Kett, because I feel like when she first arrived on the scene, it was kind of too dark for Carter or Sadie to really see her and understand.
Right.
She was very menacing, and you could see the scorpions, but that was about it. So we actually get a description of her in the chapter, and she is described as having pale skin that glistens like an insect shell.
That's an interesting description.
Yeah. My first instinct wouldn't be pale skin. Like, I would have,
yeah,
thought she would have had, like,
you know, like a darker tone or something because of the insect,
right,
you know, scorpion thing. Yeah. When I think of a scorpion, I think of a dark creature. But there are just as many pale, like, light scorpions
that is
as there
true,
are dark ones.
Like a light brown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's also described as having beady black eyes, which I think kind of fits. Long, dark hair of unnatural thickness, almost like a million bug antenna.
No thanks.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Ugh. Imagine brushing it.
Yeah.
Anyway. And then the last bit are sideways mandibles that retract out of her mouth, are usable, kind of, I'm thinking like a beetle.
Yeah.
Scorpions have them too. Now I'm suddenly flashing back to Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, where there is a scorpion. It comes out of the mouth and is sideways so they can, like, grasp things and kill things.
Yeah.
And then it goes back into her mouth and she can close her mouth, which is just weird.
That's a giant note for me. I did not enjoy this visual at all because it specifically says, like, next to her human teeth, like,
yeah,
this thing is coming out. And it's just like, I mean, we're very, very potentially getting a movie of this book. And, like, that could potentially be terrifying to see on screen.
Yeah. Like, some of the monsters from Percy are scary, but scorpions top the... they're not the top of the list for me, but they're up there. Spiders top it, but scorpions are a second for me.
See,
only because there are no scorpions, or not very many scorpions,
yeah,
in my area of the world. So, like, it's not a real and present danger, whereas spiders are everywhere.
I think I've always liked scorpions because I'm a Scorpio, so, like, there's always been
sense.
That association with scorpions. I mean, they still, like, scare me because, obviously, they can be very deadly,
mm-hmm,
but I always thought they were, like, powerful. But, like, this was creepy.
Yes,
this scared
super
me
creepy
a little bit.
I also thought it was really interesting that when Sirkat speaks, Sadie describes it being like she hasn't spoken in centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Like, her voice is, like, dark and raspy and feels like it's just never used. And I mean, if there's a way to describe a voice and make it creepy all on its own, that would be it. Let alone the description of her physical appearance. The voice itself would have probably creeped me out.
Yeah.
Okay, so we talked about Zia throwing her wand, and once she does that, Sadie's kind of, like, reading what Zia's doing at the same time, because she says, like, that was a distraction. And the minute Zia, like, sees that the wand has kind of hit its target and distracted Sirkat, she launches herself out of the circle and attacks Sirkat, which is exactly what she told Carter and Sadie not to do.
Right.
As you do. Do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah.
So, as this is all going on, the gate that they're trying to open to escape opens, and Carter starts trying to convince Sadie to join him and get out of there. I don't feel like Zia would disapprove of this. I think she wants them to get out, and she has to focus on keeping Sirkat back. But Sadie just can't bring herself to leave Zia to Sirkat and just leave her behind.
Which was really surprising to Sadie, because
yeah,
she was like, I don't know why I feel this way. Like, this is madness. Like, I shouldn't be wanting to protect this person who clearly doesn't need my protection. What can I do anyway?
I love that at the same time, Sadie's also saying, I'm not stepping into that giant cloud of sand.
Yeah.
That's not appealing either, so can we go with door number three?
I mean, I would pick the sand over the scorpion lady, like...
100 times. Like... 100 times that,
yeah,
no, for sure. And then, without really thinking, Sadie almost steps out of the chalk circle. It's only because Carter pulls her back before her foot can actually breach it that she doesn't. And Sadie has no idea what's going on. Like, she can't figure out why she's being drawn to help Zia as much as she is. And that's when Sadie actually predicts Zia's next move.
Yeah.
She says, ribbons. She can feel that Zia is about to use ribbons against Sirkat, which, if I was watching any battle, the last word that's going to come to my brain as a weapon is the word ribbons.
Yeah.
So I found this fascinating.
So did I. Specifically, she says, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
The ribbons aren't going to work. And I was like, how? Because part of me was like, this feels like a premonition, and we're really, like, wondering still what is going on with Sadie and how she can do the things that she does. And, like, being able to automatically read the hieroglyphics makes sense in my brain somehow.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like the
that
Greek
knowledge
demigods
is a part of her line, so,
yeah,
like, yeah.
But, like, Greek demigods who are hardwired for ancient Greek, like, being able to read hieroglyphics makes sense in that same sort of way.
Yeah.
But her, like, having this sort of premonition was like, what does this mean? Like, how is this magic working? And the other part of me was like, is it just that she knows what the next smartest move would be? And so she kind of, like, is predicting, not in, like, a magical sense, but in, like, a tactical sense that, like, okay, she's going to try this, but it's not going to work.
See, but I don't know how she would know, like, why would she think of ribbons?
Right, and how would she even know these things exist? Because if it was Carter, maybe, but Sadie doesn't really know anything about mythology and history.
Now, here's where my thoughts went to, there's so much we don't know about their mother.
Yeah.
It makes me feel like Sadie, as the female continuation of this line, has maybe taken on more of her mother's traits, and I wonder if her mother was not a Zia, was, like, part of Zia's, like, as women of the House of Life, they didn't have a fighting style that is not just learned, but kind of, like, becomes a part of you, and Sadie, having come from her mother, kind of has that born into her, that ingrained, like, these are things we fight with kind of thing.
I like that, like, lineage thing.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Like, that was my biggest, best guess for how she knew. Because if it had been, like, she's going to try and restrain her because that's the next move, then I would have definitely felt like it fell in line with your, just next best move in battle, kind of like a battle strategy kind of thing.
Yeah.
That would have totally made sense. But specifically guessing ribbons makes me feel like this, like, she has knowledge of all the spells at a magician's fingertips and can say, this is the next one she's probably going to use. And it would make sense if it was like, this is the one of the weapons that magicians have been using for decades, specifically, you know, this specific line of them or whatever. I am definitely intrigued to see how Sadie and Zia and Sadie's mother are all kind of related here. I want to know if there's some connections.
Yeah, for sure.
So the ribbons that Zia indeed does use next are called the Seven Ribbons of Hathor, and they seem to work. They wrap around Sirkette and defeat her. Like, they hold her down, basically, like, hold her still, and Sirkette, like, kind of seeps out of this human. We find out there's a mortal that Sirkette had kind of possessed and become her goddess form, and then once she was gone and defeated, the human remained.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, like, interesting.
Yeah.
Because, like, with Greek monsters or even Greek gods, they just, like, disappear. They poof.
Right, yeah.
And there's nothing left.
They're not, like, hosting. Like, a mortal isn't hosting a god or something like that. It's just the gods can turn into whatever form they want. So this is definitely a little bit different in the way that it works from Percy Jackson. I thought it was really interesting that before Sirkette kind of, like, she, like, comes out of the mortal in, like, black smoke. Before that happens, Zia says to her, release your host or your essence will burn forever. That's what the Ribbons of Hathor are supposed to, like, do. And that, one, was just a badass line.
It is.
But two, like, those seem to be very powerful. If you can make a god's essence burn forever, like, these are no joke. And the fact that, like, it doesn't end up working is kind of scary.
Right. That is the next thing, because the ribbons seem to work, but before they can even step away and through the portal, Sirkette starts to reform right before their eyes. So the ribbons did their job, but not as powerfully as clearly Zia has been experienced with using them.
Yeah.
And so that is when Carter reminds them that the gate's closing and maybe we should just get the heck out of here. Sadie makes her way toward the gate and Zia brings up the rear and it's time to go.
Yeah. Also, just want to shout out to Zia again for wielding the Ribbons of Hathor, because if they're that powerful, the fact that she can use them has to say something about her power level.
Yeah. I also have to say, kind of experiencing Zia fighting Sirkette in this chapter, super impressed. She's just very powerful and, like, is very confident and sure of her magician skills, and is, like, she knew that the force field was gonna hold through the scorpion attacks and, like, all that. She knew it. And it just, I was like, whew. Like,
yeah,
she's really cool. Like, you know, like, that's awesome. So, I definitely am intrigued to see Zia's role as the book goes on.
Yeah.
Okay, so that brings us to favorite quotes and favorite moments. My favorite quote is about the scorpions hitting the barrier. I believe it's Sadie who says, "Mark my words, nothing smells worse than burned scorpion."
I don't even want to know what burned scorpion smells like.
No, thank you. Yeah. Karen, what was yours?
Mine was a line from Zia because she is the coolest person that I've maybe ever seen. She says, "I am mistress of the elements, scribe of the first gnome, leave or be destroyed." Ooh, like in the movie, I'm gonna get goosebumps if she says that line. It's just, she's so cool.
Now I'm just thinking of actresses.
Oh, right, like casting.
Zoe Saldana.
Oh. But Zia's young, though, isn't she? Oh, okay.
I just want Zoe Saldana to be in everything.
I know. She's really awesome. Oh, I could see her as Bast, though.
She would be a fantastic...
She would be really good as Bast.
Netflix!
Yeah.
Listen to us.
Yeah, we know what we're talking about.
And Zoe Saldana is always up for it. Yeah. She's done with Marvel. She doesn't really have much more going with Marvel. You need to get her...
She got
to
work around her Avatar schedule, but... That's fine.
Those movies are going to be delayed 5 more times. Yeah. It's fine. You'll have plenty of time.
We are definitely doing a Cast the Red Pyramid.
We certainly are.
Episode.
Yeah.
At some
because.
Point.
Oh, yeah, yeah. She would be fantastic. Okay. Yeah. We've already fan casted that. That's done. Okay. So then we also have our favorite moments. Mine was Sadie being able to predict Zia's next move. It's just so fascinating. And I really am intrigued by what this means and how much longer we have to go and what else Sadie is going to, like, have knowledge of before we learn what's exactly going on.
Yeah.
What was your favorite?
Mine was the shadow scorpion tail thing. I just thought that was, like, a really cool visual, and it was, like, kind of scary, and like I said, I just kind of think scorpions are awesome, so...
I mean, they are pretty cool.
Yeah. They're just, they're interesting-looking creatures, and their tail is, like, iconic.
I don't know. I mean, people always make jokes about, like, dragons. Like, their tails are just as deadly or just as dangerous and all this stuff. Like, scorpions are kind of mini dragons.
Yeah,
like, they don't breathe fire usually, but... Anytime? I mean, I don't know why I added usually. Those fire-breathing scorpions just hanging
you
around.
You just
all
made
the time.
Them worse than they already were.
They
don't need to be worse, Kristen.
I definitely did. But, like, yeah, they're little, like, flightless dragons, and they just, like, run around and sting you with their poison tails. No, thank you. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to 3 other podcasts as well. Tune in to Rewatchable for in-depth discussions of your favorite canceled and cult classic TV shows, such as Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, and Angel, and more. Not About the Weather is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with our favorite creators. And lastly, Not Another Teen Wolf podcast features interviews with the cast and creators and has discussed every episode of the show, as well as the movie, and Jeff Davis's new show, Wolfpack, is currently getting the same treatment. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews help others to find us, and we appreciate every one of them. You can leave us questions, comments, ideas for episodes, or content you want to hear from us in any of these places. We do have a little bit of feedback this week from Rachel, so I'm going to throw it to Karen.
Yes, Rachel at RachelJoy23 tweeted a picture of her cat because I was like, hey, we're going to be recording in a few hours. Like, if you have any thoughts on Bast, if you have pictures of your cat, you know, send them along. And Rachel sent along pictures of Luna on her roof in both pictures, which is very interesting. I would not allow Callie out on the roof.
Kelly cannot be trusted.
Yeah, I trust her a little bit, not that much. And, that is an open invitation, by the way. If you have pictures of your cat and want to send them to us this week or any week, feel free to do that. I will probably be posting some pictures of Callie this week.
Yeah, you will always be more than welcome to post pictures of cute kitty.
She's so cute.
I think Kristen saw the picture of Luna.
I did. She's so cute.
Yeah.
Oh my god. I love kitties. Okay. So yeah, thank you very much, Rachel, for reaching out. We think Luna is adorable.
Yes.
Okay, so next week, we're going to be talking about, there's a documentary that was made about Glenn Turman's life. It's called The Legend of Glenn Turman. Very aptly named.
Yes.
And it's basically an interview, an extended interview with Glenn, where he talks about the things that kind of made him who he is and the projects that he worked on and all of that. So we're going to be watching that, and we'll have a discussion of kind of his career and also, you know, what we're excited about, what qualities of his we think will be interesting to see as Chiron and all of that. So we're really looking forward to kind of seeing who the man behind Chiron and and seeing kind of you know, look into to who he is and where he's come from and all that fun stuff. We're also going to be doing Red Pyramid chapter 13, so make sure you read that and be ready for next week. Until then, this is Kristen,
and I'm Karen,
and we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.